Welcome back to Embrace the Grain Photography Podcast. I'm Sherry Christensen, and I hope you'll enjoy the show. Hello, and welcome to episode 35 of Embrace the Grain. Tonight we have a very special guest, Mike Gutterman of the Negative Positives podcast. Hello, Mike. How are you?
Hello, Sherry. How are you? It's it's an honor to be here on your wonderful podcast. So I'm very excited about it.
Well, do you know this podcast is kind of your fault?
Well, then at least I've done something good then. So
I remember I wasn't sure if it was in the group or if it was actually on one podcast, and you had mentioned too bad there weren't more female podcasters.
All right, yeah.
And I'm sitting there and that just really stuck, and I thought, you know, maybe I should give it a try. And I kind of went down the same route that you did when you started. Can you tell us a little bit about how you started your podcast and maybe where you expected it to go when you did?
Yeah, okay. Well, I just kind of really returned back to film photography, and I was super excited about it. And all I wanted to do was talk about it. And, you know, there's only so much talk I can do with my wife about it because she's not really into photography. And I mean, she appreciates photography and she appreciates my photography and likes that I'm into it. But, you know, it's hard to talk cameras and nerd out about things with somebody that's not really into it. So I thought, you know, well, maybe I should do a podcast and I can just talk to the to outer space basically and just get all these thoughts out of my head about photography. And you know, if somebody hears it, somebody listens, great. You know, it was just kind of a way to nerd out about photography, even though I pretty much felt like I was just going to be talking to myself. And you know, when I found the Anchor app that kind of allowed you to podcast for free all on your phone, I didn't need any equipment or anything like that, and I was like, wow, this seems really easy. And because I don't know if I would have done it had it not been for the Anchor app being like this free way to do it and just talking to your phone. It just seemed like such an easy gateway into get into podcasting or whatever. And of course, then after you do that for a while, then you start start thinking, well, maybe I need to upgrade the production value of this show. And then it slowly started kind of getting upgraded production value wise, where I started doing it on the laptop with an actual mic and actually doing editing and all that stuff, and then having guests. But as far as where I thought it would go, I didn't think it would go anywhere. And I remember being shocked that you know, I was getting any listeners whatsoever, because I mean, let's face it, especially the early episodes, it was mostly just me in the garage out here drinking beer, talking about photography, just getting these thoughts off my mind, not thinking anybody was listening. And and a lot of them rather inebriated, and some of them are a little bit not necessarily coherent. But and I didn't care, because I was getting these things off my chest, you know, and it was just kind of just, when you get into a hobby and how much it just takes over your mind. I mean, you think about it all the time and it's always on your mind. And so it was just more of anything. It was just like a release to kind of get these things out of my brain. I'm still blown away by it. You know, I know a lot of people, I say it all the time, and maybe people don't believe me. It's like, oh, come on, Mike, you've been doing this. You're coming up on 300 episodes. Surely you're used to this by now. But I'm not used to it. I still occasionally look at the Anchor app, where it shows you how many people have listened to your last episode or whatever, and it still blows me away. And I never expected it, and I still don't expect it. And it still surprises me and just amazes me what has happened. And I don't want to take really the credit for it. I think it's just a sign that how much film photography has really grown in the last couple of years, and people are just that excited about it that they want to listen to stuff about it. And it just so happens that there's people like us, Sherry, you and I, that are putting out these podcasts that maybe because I think it's the thing with film photographers is we kind of feel like we're kind of on this island all by ourselves. And you know, a lot of times you might have a photographer a film photographer, and they're the only film photographer they know in their town. They don't know anybody else that shoots film photography. So I think in a way they listen to the podcast, film podcast, I think makes them feel like they're not such a weirdo, you know, or they're not alone. Yeah. So I think that's where a lot of it comes from. So, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely relate to, I'm probably the only person shooting film in my town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I imagine so. Yeah.
You know, it's like even the other day I was in town and I stopped and talked to my neighbor and he goes, "Oh, I've been following your Instagram and I really enjoy it." And I says, "Oh, I've been shooting film for the last couple years." And he goes, "Well, where do you even get that developed?"
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The sink.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny how people, I mean, it amazes me how many people just think that film photography really did just die and go away when digital came out, that like all these big companies like Kodak just gave up, you know, and mm-hmm. it's not, the, you know, it's just weird how that seems to be the general consensus of what the general public thinks, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's actually a photographer himself, like a hobbyist. And it still kind of surprised me that, yeah, he didn't realize that film was still a thing.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah. Thankfully it is, and it's growing. So these people are gonna find out one of these days. We're gonna take over the world by storm. So yeah,
I won't be able to get my gold in Walmart if I keep telling everybody how great it is.
There you go. At least you can get gold in Walmart. All I can get is like the Fuji. So yeah, but
that's all I can get.
Wow. Yeah, I would prefer the gold over the Fuji. So I think we did a swap once where I gave you some Fuji for some of your Kodak. So
yeah. It's so you mentioned 300 episodes. So are you ready for that 300th episode?
Well, as of us recording this at this point tonight, tomorrow night is when we actually record the 300th episode giveaway. And I spent a good part of last night, like, trying to organize it. And let's just say I'll be here in the garage in the gutter man cave very late again tonight, still organizing this thing, because we got so many entries and so many prizes to give away. And it's a bit of an organizational nightmare. But let me tell you, it's kind of a labor of love, because I'm just blown away by what the community has, how they've responded to this whole 300 episodes, and just all the things that the listeners are giving to other listeners. It's just it's a real testament to how cool the film community actually is. And we talk about it all the time. And it really is a special thing we have within the film community, that people are just so generous. And I don't know that there's very many other hobbies where you run into that kind of generosity and willing to share knowledge as much as the film community. I think it's something special and unique that we have going on.
Yeah, yeah. So recently you won two awards on the Sunnies, on the Sunny 16 podcast. Was that a huge surprise to you?
Yes, I did.
Hello?
Well, it was actually. And yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it was a huge surprise. And, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about it when it happened. I was like, you know, I have never been someone that really excelled at anything. I was horrible at sports. And I don't have a whole lot of trophies or awards in my life. And I never was like a super popular guy in high school. So I didn't win any of the popularity contests or anything like that. So it was kind of, honestly, I think the Sunny Awards is maybe one of the few awards I've ever won in my life. So I definitely, was quite kind of humbled by it and just blown away. It was a real treat. And, I just thank anybody that, would have taken the time to vote for me on those. That was a super, super cool.
So, Mike, do you think that with photography, that other things that are like drawing and music and maybe even pottery or woodworking, they all kind of intermingle as a creative type thing?
Sure, yeah. I think I find that a lot of people in photography have other hobbies, and for whatever reason, photography seems to be something that seems to draw a lot of creative people from a lot of other different sort of creative outlets. I'm not really sure why that is. Maybe it's because as photographers, we're kind of visually sort of acute to things around us. And then so we appreciate other things that we see and then want to get involved with those things as well. It's a kind of a strange phenomenon, but I do kind of see like I think the thing is, I think everybody has the ability to be creative in one way or another. And I think, you know, it's defining what good creative outlet you want to, that you're kind of maybe geared for. I was lucky because I thought music was my one and only thing, and I never was really really great at it. I just keep doing it. But, you know, I was kind of forced to go to photography because I always was kind of interested in it. But I had a situation where I had a band breakup, and it didn't really have any bands to kind of on the horizon that I could join or kind of form. And so I was like, well, maybe this is now the time to take up photography. You know, it's something I can do by myself. I don't have to rely on other people to show up and for band practice or whatever. And so I was kind of I'm kind of glad that happened. It was a shitty time in music for me because I didn't really have any functioning band and it was driving me crazy, but it did kind of get me into photography. And so I can at least, I found a little, you know, a little ray of sunshine in that situation. And look where it's got me now, 300 episodes of a podcast. So.
You also attend, is it the Louisville Unfair?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a type of an art show, correct?
Sure. Yeah, it is. It's an outside art show that happens the first weekend of October every year. I think this year will be my 14th year in it. And it's a small local art fair, but it's right next to a huge art fair that's basically the second biggest outside art show in the United States, and it's called the St. James Art Fair, and it draws people from all over the country, and thousands and thousands of people, but it doesn't allow a lot of local artists in. I think they only allow like two artists, local artists, in to have a booth in that main fair. So this unfair started as a reaction, kind of against that, like, hey, here's some local artists that you can check out while you're looking at all these artists from around the country. You can come over here right next to it to the Louisville Unfair and check out local art. And it just so happens I had a friend that was working at the bar that I was always hanging out at, and he was one of the guys that started this unfair, and he knew I was into photography and had me bring in like a portfolio to show him. And once he took a look at my work, he was like, man, I think your stuff would do well in this unfair, and you should try it. And there was no way. I was so nervous about it. No, I don't want to put my stuff in front of thousands of people. It'll be nerve wracking. But I did it, you know, and I forced myself to do it. And the first year was awful. And the second year was a little better. And each year it just kept getting better and better. And I started selling more and more and more. And here I am coming up on 14 years of selling photography at this big art show, and it's just been a real blast, and it's been a real eye opening about you know, how people respond to your work. And I think it's real beneficial. If you ever get a chance, anyone out there that's listening, get a chance to exhibit your work even at a small little outside art show, you know, just try to, you know, have cheap prices and see if people will open up their wallets and what they'll buy, or what, even just even if they don't buy anything, the conversations you have with people that walk up and check out your work and the kind of questions they ask and stuff like that. It really can kind of illuminate a little bit about what people think about what you do in your photography. And I think it's just a great experience, whether you make any money at it or not. It's definitely a good learning process.
So there's probably a whole ton of preparation involved in getting ready for something like that.
Yeah. It's about the whole month of September. I'm pretty much, I think last year I even said in September, I'm taking the month off from photography. And it was sort of to recharge my batteries, but in photography, but mostly it was because I needed that month to frame and cut mats and print photos. So yeah. So the month leading September is usually a pretty busy month of getting ready for it, because, you know, I'll end up bringing like, oh gosh, probably about 100 framed items or so to this show. And I mean, there's been shows I've sewed almost 100 pieces over 3 days. So yeah, it's huge. I mean, there's that many people that come through there. And so you have to have, when you're there all day for 3 straight days and you get that many people coming through, it's surprising how, you know, there was one year before things really kind of started taking off, and I only brought like 20 things. And like after the first day, I didn't have much on my wall, and I had to go home that night and frantically print and frame stuff just to have something for the next day, you know, because I didn't know that it was going to sell that well, you know, because I hadn't had years like that in the past. And just for some reason, this particular year, my stuff was resonating with people, I guess. And it was kind of a rush. So I try to limit that, because you get home from these shows and you're so tired from being there all day. The last thing you want to do is come home and frame more and print more and stuff like that. But, you know, I had to do it that year, but I've tried to make sure that doesn't happen anymore. It's a little much, but,
Yeah. So, what would be your, top two things that you would recommend to someone thinking about doing something like this?
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, I think the main thing is to just, go into your first show, with no expectations of selling anything, because particularly if it's a show you're going to be able to do again, like if it's an annual type show, the main thing you want to do on your first show is just go in there, throw a bunch of different types of photography, as many different types as you can, of your style or whatever, on your wall or your display or whatever, and just see what resonates, and just try to make your first art show as something that a learning process to kind of figure out what type of your work kind of resonates with people. And then that way, the next year you can kind of concentrate on those things that seem to be what people are interested in, you know, because the bottom line, you're there to sell stuff, you know. It's great for people to see your work, but I mean, at the end of the day, you want to come home with some money in your wallet. So,
yes.
I guess the second thing would be, pricing. It's a really hard part. And, it took me a while to figure it out. I started a little too high, and then I've went a little too low at times, and I've kind of found a middle ground where I sell quite a bit, but I still make enough profit. So it's really about getting your materials as cheap as possible. For me particularly, I'm always obsessed with finding the cheapest frames that I could possibly can, saving money by cutting my own mats, things like the HP Instant Ink printer, which allows me to print really, really cheaply, because, you know, it is the hottest trend in home printing. It's taking over the world by storm. So things like that have keep my costs down, which allows me to sell at a lower price. And that is what helps you sell, because I think we get a little bit kind of butthurt as photographers about the fact that people don't value photography as much as like a painting. And maybe they shouldn't, because it took somebody a really long time to paint this painting, and it's a one of a kind, whereas we can go home and make another copy of a photograph and bring it to the show the next day. That you know, anything you sold, you can make another copy and bring it the next day. So, but people don't hold as high a value in photography as an art form. So, you know, trying to not be too egotistical about your work and realize that, hey, photography is a cheaper art form, and it should be. You kind of have to take that into consideration when you're looking at pricing. So that'd be kind of my two things that I've learned from doing it for all these years. So, yeah.
Wow. That's cool. So, why are you a great big Pentax guy?
Well, it really stems from my dad. It's he was a Pentax man. And, when I was in my senior year of high school, I took two courses. You know, in my last year of high school, I had a bunch of electives to take. Most of my main classes were kind of out of the way. So I had one elective was photography, and so I took that. And the other one was the yearbook staff. And on the yearbook staff, since I was already in photography class, and I was already carrying around an SLR that I brought from my dad, a Pentax K1000, a working man's camera. And they threw me in the dark room as one of the dark room and staff photographers for the yearbook. So I basically had a camera with me most of my senior year, walking around with this Pentax K1000 that my dad lent me and told me not to break. And and I guess it's just, you know, my first real attempts at using a real camera was a Pentax, and it just kind of stuck with me. And to be honest, I always, because that's what my dad used, I always just thought, well, they must be the best, you know, dad, he found something to him. So they must be the best brand. So I just stuck with it. You know, when I went and bought my first real camera, it was a Pentax, and I just stuck with it. And I never had any problems with it. I never had any reason to go to anything else, truthfully. So yeah, just it's brand loyalty based from family loyalty, I guess. So,
yeah. It's what you grew up and learned on.
Sure.
Yeah. So, what camera would be your date camera? Which one would you marry? And which one is, shh, I don't want anyone to know I was with her.
Wow. Okay. Date camera, marry camera, embarrassed about camera. Okay. Date would be probably the Pentax 6-7 because she's loud, she's proud, a little boisterous. It would probably be a good fun date, but a whole life with her, you know, that shutter sounds very loud, so she would have she would be very very loudly all the time. So so maybe that would be the one I would date. And marriage, I guess maybe the trusty Pentax K1000. You know, it's dependable, reliable, simple, gets the job done, makes me happy. Probably the K1000, I guess. And one I'd be embarrassed about being seen with, I don't know. I love her a lot, but maybe the Holga, you know, because her name's Holga, you know, like, hey guys, I met this new girl. Her name's Holga. Like, gonna be like, Holga? Like, what in the world? You're dating a clinic Holga? Yeah, that would probably that's just off the top of my head right now, I guess. So,
so two Pentaxes and Holga. So, you know, I heard some new industry news today, and nobody has heard this yet. So this is breaking news.
I haven't.
Okay. So I'm wondering, you know, Kodak has put out this, they're bringing in a new film and a new camera. And I was wondering if they've called you yet to be the spokesperson, because I heard it's APS.
Well, it is the hottest trend in film photography. It's taken over the world by storm. So that does not surprise me one bit that this news has finally come out. You know, we've all been waiting for it, and it's been. APS. Well, I so wish that was true, but I'm having a hard time believing you on that one. So,
well, you got me. It's fake news, but it's all fun.
Right. Yeah. That's funny because a lot of people wonder where the APS thing comes from. And mostly at this point, it's just a running joke that I like to keep continuing, but I do shoot it and I have fun with it. And it's so cheap the cameras are so cheap. I'm looking at two APS SLRs on top of my printer here right now. And, they're loaded with film right now, ready to be shot. And you get the film so cheap. And like I said, the cameras are so cheap. And, but in the 90s, when I got engaged to my girlfriend, who's now my wife, I went and bought. I need a new camera. I need a really nice camera because we're getting ready, you know, get married, and there's gonna be a honeymoon, and buying a new house, and we need a good camera to document our lives, right? So, I go to the camera store, and you know, I go in there thinking I'm gonna buy a 35mm camera. You know, that's all right. I really know. And the camera store guy's like, oh no, we got this new thing, advanced photo system. I'm like, whoa, advanced. What's going on with this? You know, so. And so he starts telling me about it, and I said, oh, this is great. You just drop it in there, and it's advanced, man. It's advanced photos. This has got to be the highest new technology out there. And in a way it was pretty high tech for the time. But I tell you the strange thing that sold me on it more than anything was, you know, when you're not a photographer, and I wasn't at that time, I was just a snapshot guy. I did value snapshots, but I wasn't trying to be a photographer or anything like that. But as that kind of shooter, what always irritated me is what to do with negatives. And like, you know, you got your prints back from the drugstore and they had the negatives kind of loosely in that front flap of the paper sleeve that your prints came in, and they would fall out everywhere. And it was just a pain. When you're not a photographer and you're not into like what to do with your negatives, the old system with the way the drugstore were giving your negatives back was a pain in the ass. And so this APS, you know, you got your negatives back in the cartridge. They wouldn't spill out everywhere. So you could just save these cartridges. And then
you got this nice little binder.
Yeah,
and you
can
pop
binders.
The cartridges in them.
That's right. I have like three of those binders are filled with cartridges. And it's so cool. And it, you know, when you got your prints back, they would give you an index print. And it would have like the cartridge number on the top of the index print, and then every a little thumbnail of every picture on that roll of film, and you kept those index prints in that binder with your, you know, with your APS cartridges. And, you know, if you ever wanted to reprint, you just went to cartridge 182-687 and you pulled out the index print and figure out what frame number you wanted, and you just took it to the lab and I need frame 15 on a 5x7. And it just, it was just so much easier. And for somebody that, you know, for the consumer, I thought it was a really good idea, and it really did serve my needs. And we, you know, that I bought a little Kodak Zoom APS camera and it took fantastic photos. So I've got no problem with, the quality I was getting out of APS at that time, because we were just getting 4x6s and they were perfect. And I have some really, really great photos on APS film in the 90s. Of course, they're all 4x6, but you know, it served its need for me at the time, and I still have like this. I think this little romance with it, because it was kind of an important phase in my life that I was shooting nothing but APS at the time. So I think there's a little bit of soft spot there for me there.
Yeah. I have a funny story about APS. About a year and a half ago, I was cleaning out the basement closet in the bedroom, and I found this roll of APS film in the back corner. And of course, it's cool down there, so it's stored well, right? So I sent it away to the lab, and they developed it. It didn't come back in the cartridge, though.
Oh, wow.
They had cut it and sleeved it and never put it back in the cartridge. But I laughed so hard. They were of my kids when they were 12 and 14.
Wow.
Before they were allowed to have cell phones.
Oh, so they were actually engaged with real life.
Yeah. And they were trying to take selfies of themselves with this little point and shoot APS camera.
Nice.
And there's like all these pictures up the nostrils.
Oh yeah. Yep.
And they take pictures of each other's butt. I got this envelope back and I opened it up and I just roared with laughter, and they're like, "Oh, Mom, throw those out." And I said, "Not a chance in hell."
Right. Oh, that's awesome. See, that's the amazing thing about, you know, I got a chance to develop a whole bunch of film for my aunt that she had like 30 rows of like her daughter growing up that she never got processed. And they were just in a closet for like years and years in this box. And so when she found out I was developing film at home, she's like, can you do me a favor? Would you be interested in developing these? I was like, absolutely. Because, you know, there was photos of me and my wife when we were dating on some of these rows of film that she had in her closet. And just like it was a little time capsule of like her daughter's whole childhood sitting on film that had never been developed. And it was actually really, really cool to do that for her. And she was really amazed to see like how much she'd been missing out on all these years by not having those photos developed. Yeah. So,
yeah.
That's pretty wild what you can find sometimes on those old rows, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, why do you think just the plain snapshot is important, even if it's like your iPhone snapshot? Why is that even important?
I think it's because, you know, I've talked about it quite a bit on the show, but things that you think are mundane today, 10, 20 years from now won't be mundane anymore. And those snapshots, a lot of times there's things in the background that, you know, if you were trying to take an artsy fartsy, photograph, you might eliminate those things. Oh, that's distracting, you know, but like on these snapshots, you don't give a crap about that stuff. And sometimes you'll look back at these old photos and you'll see like maybe a piece of furniture or a clock on the wall. Like, oh man, I remember that clock, or it's, you know, or my mom having that, or this or whatever. Like there's always these little things in the background that kind of blow me away, that when you see photos from 10, 20 years ago, the things you completely forgot about. But beyond that is snapshots are usually of your family and it's usually of your daily life. And I think those are the things that we'll really treasure going down the road more than that awesome photo of a fire escape you took, you know. So it's just what really means, you know. The thing about a snapshot, like if my house was to catch on fire, like the one thing I would try to grab, and everybody says this, but I would grab my photo albums, and my photo albums are filled with nothing but mostly crappy snapshots, and not even really. Because most of them are from before I was even into photography. And, you know, now there might be some nice portraits in there because I'm into photography now. But it doesn't matter. I don't value those portraits that I really tried to get some good shallow depth of field, some real bokeh in there. You know, I don't value those any more than the cheesy snapshots of, I don't know, blown out flash picture of my wife when we first were dating or something like that. Or, you know, those, they all mean the same. It's all a picture of a loved one. And I think that's the beauty of a snapshot is it doesn't have to be fantastic photography for it to mean something. And because it's usually of people you love and things you'll want to remember going down the road. So yeah, there's nothing really more valuable than the snapshot, truthfully, in photography.
Or so you can sit down and go, oh, remember when we all had the same sofa, you know, that brown one with the,
right. All the flowers on it? Yeah.
Yeah. We had that one too.
Yeah. Everybody had that one.
Yeah. But yeah. So I think right here we will take a little break so my audio stays even here.
Sounds good.
We will be right back.
Excuse me, miss. Does that camera of yours give you easy drop and loading like this? No way. That can give you three different picture options for better pictures more often? Oh, too bad. How about an index print so it's easy to order reprints? Nah, didn't think so. Maybe what you need isn't just another camera. What you need is an advanced photo system like Kodak Advantix. It's a special kind of film. It's a different kind of camera. It's a better way to take pictures further.
And we are back. So, Mike, recently you have sold a few cameras, and I was just wondering, you know, do you actually miss them or wish that you hadn't sold them or that type of thing?
Actually, I was worried that I was going to miss them, but I really haven't. And it kind of surprises me. And because over the last year, I've talked a lot about trying to lighten the load, sell some cameras. And because I think I finally figured out the ones I really kind of just grab all the time. And some of the ones I sold are technically better cameras than the ones I use all the time. But for whatever reason, they just... I just wasn't using them much, and I think I was holding them a little too precious because, oh, well, this is a Pentax KX, you know, this is a MX. These are some of the top of the line Pentax from the day, you know, and, but I really wasn't shooting them much. I just kept grabbing the K1000. I just enjoyed it more for whatever reason. And so, but when I finally decided to sell them, I kind of chose those cameras because they are, you know, higher end. You know, I could get a little more money out of them, I guess. But what I ended up doing was I just put them on the Facebook group and sold them there. Sold them for a little less than what they're worth, but I thought that was worth it because I wouldn't have to deal with the hassles of eBay and worry right. about like getting some kind of a-hole kind of buyer that wants to give me problems down the road or whatever. And secondly, like selling them to people in the community that I at least, you know, knew or have some sort of acquaintance with made it a whole lot easier. And I think is another reason why I don't miss them because I know they went to good homes, you know, people that really appreciate right. them and will use them more than I was. So I really haven't had any regrets about it. And I'm actually surprised and I'm glad. So, yeah.
Yeah. Cause I know I've got, a very large collection and mm-hmm. I've slowly,
it
yeah, it's slowly been paring it down. But it doesn't help when my mom says, I went to a garage sale and I just bought you 9 cameras. Anyway.
Yeah, like, oh. Although I do kind of wish I had an enabler like that. It's not the worst of problems, but.
No, it's not. But it's like, okay, some more stuff needs to go.
Yeah, but, yeah.
You know, it's just when they arrive back here from the States, when she comes home, it's, I'll have to test them all and make sure that the seals are good in them. And I might just resell some of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's part of the journey. And I did the same thing with music gear. You know, I figured out at one time it, throughout my life, I've owned like almost 100 guitars and I'm down to only owning 4 at this point. And, but that journey was a long journey and an expensive one that to finally get me down to like the instruments that actually kind of feel right in my hands that are actually, I think, the sound that I want. And the same thing happened with cameras. You know, it took me a long time to really figure out, what I like to shoot and what really, you know, motivates me or just kind of gets me, like, what cameras I gravitate towards, what I like to grab when I go, what I actually enjoy shooting out in the field or whatever. So I think it's sometimes it takes some people get to it on a lot shorter path than I did, but I'm not mad that I had a lot of cameras or I still have a lot of cameras to get me to where I'm at now, because if it gets you to your final destination of figuring out what cameras really resonate with you the best, then it's all worth it. Plus, it's fun, right? I mean, experiment with all this new cameras. So yeah, it's not like it's not a real painful process. So it's a lot of fun. It's good times. So yeah.
But I really don't need 6 Spotmatics.
Yeah, redundancy, that was a problem I was getting into too, like, you know. One thing when I was looking at selling, that's kind of what I did. I sort of broke things down to categories. Okay, I need one manual, fully manual 35 millimeter SLR. I need one autofocus whiz bang plastic fantastic 35 millimeter SLR. I need a 6.45, a 6.7, and, you know, some toy cameras, a couple of small compacts, and that kind of covers all my bases, right? And and once I was able to kind of really realize the categories that I like to shoot in, then just narrowing it down to one or two cameras in those categories and just getting rid of redundancy was really was how I was able to kind of pare down. So yeah,
I know when I first sold my first F100 to Betsy Carl, it was like, oh, I don't want to sell it. I really love this camera, but I just bought an F6. I have to sell it to pay for it.
Yeah.
I'm going to miss it so much, but you know what?
You got an F6, you know?
I got an F6, but
right.
2 weeks later, I'm out there shooting the F6, and it's like, I don't miss it. I hope she does well with it.
right. I hear you there.
But and it was an awesome camera. I know it'll do her well. But that first initial, I don't want to sell it because I like it, was hard.
I know when I was boxing up these cameras that I sold, you know, a couple weeks ago, I was like, let me just box this up real quick. I don't want to think about this. And
before I change my mind.
right. I already got their money. I can't change my mind now. So,
who are a few people that you find a total inspiration, either well-known or maybe not so well-known?
Wow, that's a tough one. I would start with, you know, I guess everyone has some like masters of photography or whatever that kind of resonates with them a little bit. And for me, I took an art appreciation class in college, and I remember I had to write a paper about an artist, and we could choose any artist, visual artist basically. And so we had this book of all these ideas of artists we could write our paper about or whatever. And you know, it was an Ansel Adams photo that stuck out for me. It was the moonrise over whatever it is.
Right. And, everybody knows that one.
Yeah. And I was like, oh wow, look at this photograph, this is amazing. And and I wasn't, you know, really an artsy guy or whatever, and I really wasn't even into photography at that time, but something about that photo stuck out, and that's what I ended up writing my big paper on for that class. And I think I got an A on it, so maybe I can give Ansel some credit there. But, you know, obviously, I don't think I do any photography, anything like him, but that, I think, is what the first photo that got me to appreciate photography or even see it as an art form. And then when I did get back into photography, I would go to our local, like, it's called Half Price Books, where they have, like, you know, a lot of cheap books, and they have a huge photography section. And I just would buy different masters art, you know, photo books or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I found this guy named Wynn Bullock, and he is, and obviously Edward Weston. I found some of his books, and I really liked Ansel and Edward Weston. But then there was something about Wynn Bullock's work that, to me, he was like a mix of Ansel, like the perfect in between Ansel and Edward Weston, and like, so he really resonated with me. And I would say, like, out of the masters, he's the one that I like the most. And he just has a different, his own vibe that has a little Ansel and a little bit of Edward Weston, but his own thing as well. And I just, that really resonated with me. And then as far as, you know, inspirations beyond that, it's mostly been the photography I see in the community. People on the Facebook group have been where most of my inspiration comes from nowadays. And because that's about the only photography I really check out anymore. I don't, really buy photo books anymore. I just check out the Facebook group or Instagram people that I follow. And it's just been, you know, most of the inspiration comes from that. And I hate to really give any names because so many people I've found inspiration from, and I don't want to forget. So I'd rather than naming one or two people, I just say everyone out there that's on the Facebook group has just done some fantastic work. And I was actually blown away. I'm in Neil Piper's project box camera, and we're starting to see some photos come through already from the first month of that project on the Facebook group he has for that. And I was blown away about some of these photos that these people people in that group are getting out of these lowly box cameras. And it was really inspiring. Like here we have the most simple form of camera, and these photos are just incredible. And so sometimes you think you need all this technology and the best cameras and stuff, but then you see these photos taken out of a simple box with a hole in it, and it just blows you away. And so it's just been, most of my inspiration now just comes from seeing what people we know in the community are doing. So, yeah.
I know that Matt Melcher is shooting the Frugal Film Project on box cameras this year.
Yeah.
And I believe he is also in Neil's group.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Neil's whole idea about doing this thing came from Matt Melcher. So Matt's to blame for all this madness.
I've seen Matt's January pictures for the Frugal done on the box, and they were just amazing.
Yeah, it really is incredible what you can get out of those cameras, and I'm looking forward to. I've got three box cameras and that I'll be shooting through that project. And I've always enjoyed shooting my Brownie Hawkeye, but there's a couple others I hadn't even shot yet that I'm looking forward to trying. And it's just, you know, it's amazing what you can get out of them. And, you know, I know some of these box cameras will shoot like 6x9s. And when you're talking that big of a negative, it really doesn't matter that the lens is not the sharpest. It might be the most simple lens design on the planet. But when you're dealing with that big of a negative, you're still getting a really incredibly detailed photograph out of these things. So,
yeah. Because I think he used a Aqua Imperial Savoy, I believe.
Oh yeah,
for
yeah,
January. Yeah, it's awesome really cameras. Pretty.
All the Imperial cameras. I've got one myself.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, that's my bench looking at me. I have the Imperial Mark 12, and it's an aqua kind of greenish color from straight from the 50s, right? And it looks like something that would be on a Route 66 diner or something like that. If anybody listening gets a chance to look up Imperial cameras from the name of the company was, let's see what it's the Herbert George Company in Chicago, Illinois. If you look at their cameras, they're just amazing. They're these like just beautiful space age looking mid-century kind of design cameras. And they're the coolest looking little cameras you can imagine. And they all have like these kind of spacey looking graphics on there and stuff. So it's just, they're super cool. But I'm looking forward to shooting mine too. The one I have in particular, the reason I bought it is someone called it, "This is the American Hoga." And I was like, oh, you sold me right there. You said Hoga. So.
Oh, there's that one you don't want to be caught with, hey?
There you go.
So last summer, you shot a little bit of Super 8. Mm. Now, can you give us your thoughts on the Super 8? Will you do it again?
I absolutely will do it again. Matter of fact, over Christmas break, Mike Rosso gave me a phone call, which was unbelievable. He gave me a text and he said, "Hey, Mike, do you got some time to chat?" And I was like, "Mike Rosso wants to talk to me on the phone from the FBP." This is one of those moments where I remember getting off the phone. I was like, "Manette, when I started my podcast, I never imagined I'd have a day where Mike Rosso would just want to call me on the phone and chat a little bit." And that's pretty damn cool. But anyway.
So you were squealing like a little girl.
It was really cool, but we spent about a half hour talking about Super 8 and basically regular 8, which he's been pushing a lot lately. Mike, I give him a lot of credit because I was talking about – I was going on a Florida vacation, and I wanted to try Super 8 for the first time. And Mike, I sent him some text messages asking him, you know, how to get into it, what I really need to do about exposure. I was totally green at it, and he was very helpful. and even kind of set me up with a functioning camera that that he knew would work for me. Basically, I think trying to hook me so he'd have another ambassador out there for Super 8. So, and he hooked me because I went out to Florida and I shot this thing and it was just so much fun. I brought two cartridges, which is, you know, about 6 minutes of footage. And so it isn't cheap, and I'll be the first. Everyone knows that. But I just had a real blast shooting it. And honestly, I took more video on those things than I would have with my phone, because there was just something about having that camera, that movie camera there with real film in it, you know, and it just made me pick it up and shoot things that maybe I wouldn't have shot on my phone or whatever, because we hardly ever shot video on our phones on vacation or whatever. But this thing kind of made me do it. And then when I got the footage back, it just blew me away. Just the kind of sort of timeless classic look that Super 8 film has. It looks like it could have been shot in the 1950s because of the way it looks, or, you know, if it wasn't for like the modern cars and some of the footage, you wouldn't really know what year this was shot, because it just has this, you know, that vintage look to it. And
right.
I was just, I'm sold on it, and it's not going to be something I'll, you know, get completely immersed in, but I definitely want to shoot more of it. And, it's going to be, I will never go on a vacation without a Super 8 camera and some film. But I do kind of want to maybe do it a little bit more than just vacations. I actually have plans. The next time I'm in a functioning band, I want to actually, you know, shoot a music video of whatever band I'm in on Super 8, and because I think that would be a lot of fun. But yeah, there's some other things I'd like to do with it. But yeah, it's just, it was a blast. I will say the trick, and a lot of people say this, and I found it to be entirely true, is, you know, every second is costing you money on the thing. So, and for the sake of the making your footage interesting, what I did was each scene, when I hit that trigger and that film started rolling, I would count 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, and 5 seconds max. Sometimes I just go 3 seconds, like make every little scene 3 to 5 seconds and cut it, you know, just
right.
Think about what you want to capture. And stop, go no longer than 5 seconds, because any longer than that, especially with the attention spans of people today, you know, they, it becomes boring. So just keep it moving, keep the scenes changing, you know, and that way you get, yeah, you know, I found it pretty easy to document an entire week of our vacation in just 6 minutes of footage, just by doing that, you know, because there's so many little tiny mini scenes through those 6 minutes of our vacation that kind of really told the story of our trip. In 6 short minutes, and that's really about all you want, right? No one wants right. to sit down for 2 hours and watch, you know, a home video of 2 hours of videotape or whatever. Yeah, so yeah, it's just I have videotape. I just showed my age there. No one shoots videotape anymore either. But
I don't know. I have a videotape camera, and I have blank tapes too.
I do too. I have one blank tape for my video camera. I think it's what is it? It's not Super 8. It's Digital 8 or something like.
Yes.
It's something like. Yeah. And I have one tape left, and I'm going to shoot it. I mean, why not? I got to use this last tape up, you know, but so, yeah.
Would you think that on the Super 8 that it would be helpful to like storyboard it like in advance in your head exactly what you want to shoot?
I think so. I mean, particularly if you're trying to do a project where you're really trying to tell a story or something, like particularly if I end up doing like a music video, that's something I would be a little more methodical about the way I approached it, and would probably do a more of a storyboard sort of thing with that. But as far as the vacation, I didn't really do anything like that. I just, you know, when I would see something, I'd be like, yeah, I should probably get a little bit of this on the Super 8. And I would run into the condo, grab it. And, you know, and I kind of knew what I wanted to shoot. And I would just think about it right before I hit the trigger and then do it. The first couple of times it was kind of nerve wracking because, you know, this is not cheap. And and one thing I also learned was my particular camera has a zoom on it. Don't use it, because when you zoom in, if you're hand holding, if you zoom in, that camera is going to shake so bad and you can't tell until you see the footage. Like, yeah, I will never use the zoom again, because I did a couple of scenes where I you know, had it on wide and then zoomed into telephoto to like kind of zoom in on something, kind of, you know, get this cool zoom. You know, let's really get to the subject of this amazing film that I'm making here. But it would just start shaking so bad once you get to the telephoto range of the lens. I was like, yeah, I won't be doing that anymore. Next time, I'll never zoom. So,
so how do you actually focus them? Or when they're all the way wide, they're just focused? Or
mine had a focus, like just a little sort of a zone focus thing where, like, basically, you know, it just told me the feet on the lens of their focus. I think, and don't quote me on this, but I believe if you focus, like if you're gonna zoom, which, you know, since I won't be zooming anymore, it'd be pretty easy to do the focus because I'll know about where I'm gonna, how far my subject is. But if you were gonna zoom, I think the way you do it is you set the focus for it zoomed all the way, like telephoto, and then when you go back to wide, it'll still be in focus. I think that's how you do it, or it's opposite. It's one or the other. I won't be doing any zooming anymore. So my camera just has a zone focus, the feet marked on the lens. So, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I've never shot any. I do have one, but I'm just kind of haven't pulled the pin on doing it yet.
Yeah, it's a bit nerve-wracking, but, you know,
I don't even know if the camera works.
Yeah, then that's the problem. So definitely don't do it. Don't make your first time shooting it something extremely important, just to get some really mundane footage. And which is, that's a problem. It's expensive to just, you know, as a test, even just a test one's expensive. But
yeah,
once you get it, like this little Super 8 thing that we did of our vacation, it's going to be something I'm going to cherish for the rest of my life, you know? And so I can't put a price on that. Yeah, it wasn't the cheapest thing I've ever done, but it wasn't so expensive that I'll never do it again. I'm certainly going to do it again because I know it's something that I'm really going to cherish. And I actually want to start writing some music to put some music over top of it because, you know, there's no sound. So you really kind of need music to kind of bring it to life. And so one of my goals is to write a little of my own music or whatever to put on top of the film footage to kind of just finish it basically. And then, it's just a lot of fun. And yeah, you know, having it on film, you know, it's archival, right? So there you go.
I was actually, I just bought a kit to digitize my digital 8 tapes. Mm-hmm. Because all of when my kids were little, all of that stuff is on there.
Yeah, yep.
And I do still have a functioning VCR, so I could hook it up, but I don't know how it would work on a smart TV.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, yeah, I went through a huge project of getting a lot of VHS and, oh gosh, regular 8mm from the 90s, a lot of stuff digitized, and it was a long process. And a lot of these tapes were from the late 80s through mid 90s, I would say. Mm-hmm. And I was getting, it's a good thing I digitized them when I did, because these are, you know, these are magnetic tapes basically. And the magnets on like VHS tapes or whatever, they only really supposed to be good for about 10 years before they start having dropouts. And I was starting to get a lot of dropouts in some of my footage. So it's, I kind of caught them really at the expiration point on those things. So actually past the expiration point really, but I was getting there's a lot of dropouts on some of those tapes that had just been in storage forever. And so if you have old videotapes sitting around, it's if past 10 years, it's probably, you need to think about getting those transferred to something else for sure. Yeah.
Well, let's just say that the one kid's 30 and the other one's 28. So they might be a little old.
Yeah. Well, some of mine weren't stored all that well. There was one point I think they were in a hot attic, and then so we didn't necessarily care for them the way we should have. And so there's a little, nothing was completely lost, but there's definitely was some degradation of how they looked for sure.
Yeah, I'll have to get on that. I've got all the equipment here now, and I dug out the camera and dusted that off. It had a nice coat of dust on it, so I just need to hook it up, and it's a lot of time just letting it sit and run.
Yeah, yeah, it is. But I tell you, you'll find it's kind of, tedious as that might sound, you'll end up loving it because you'll see this footage you haven't seen in years. And, you know, it's like going through an old photo album or something. All these memories will come back. as long as it took for me to digitize all of our old video cassettes, it really was kind of a joy to see all that footage again. So,
yeah. And maybe my grandson might enjoy seeing his mom as a little kid.
There you go. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I'm starting to run out of questions, so I'm going to ask you this one. What is your most favorite film?
Ooh,
that's a hard one.
It is a hard one. A year or so ago, I would have said Tri-X just immediately. It would have popped right out of there. And, but honestly, I'm kind of leaning. I've really enjoyed Double X, the Eastman Double X a lot. And that's a film that I just recently, well, not recently, about 6-8 months ago, maybe a year ago, I bought like 100 foot of it that's still in my freezer. So I need to crack into that and start shooting more of it, because there's something about Eastman Double X that, as much as I love Tri-X, I think there's just this, I hate to say it because it's a cinema film, but there is like this cinematic quality to Double X that just, it just gives me something, man, that I don't get out of a lot of other films. And it just has a unique look that, I don't know, it just resonates. And I'm not really, can't put my finger on it, but I'm like, there's something special about this film and I need to shoot more of it. And maybe I can give you a better answer of what's so special about it. But the roles I've shot have just been amazing. And Tri-X has been always one of my favorites. And like I said, a year ago, that would have been an easy answer. But man, Double X might be kind of starting to knock it out of the champion's chair there. Also, like, it really kind of depends on the application too, because like Hogas or like box cameras and stuff like that, I really love T-Max 100 because, you know, that's not a film I normally would gravitate towards because it's almost like too sharp and too grain free. It almost, some people, you know, say it still looks too much like digital because it's so clean and so sharp, you know. But in these little toy cameras, I think it's the perfect mix, you know, having this really sharp, like really grain free film and a camera with a lens that is less than spectacular. I think that's an interesting, I really do enjoy using T-Max 100 in like toy cameras, which seems so wrong in so many levels, but to use one of the sharpest films ever and one of the least sharp cameras. So, but that just works for me. Yeah.
I have one of the original Dianas. Like from way back in the, I don't know, 60s.
Yeah.
And I threw a roll of film in there and I went out all excited and shot it. Worst thing I ever did. It just, you couldn't even discern the people's faces in the photos. Wow. It was so bad.
Yeah, that's the problem with, I've wanted to get a vintage Diana for a long time. But they were so spotty on, you know, the lenses. You could get a good one or a really bad one. So I've been a little leery to pull the trigger on one. But I got lucky with my Hoga, and I always call it my magic Hoga because I just got so lucky with it, because the center region of mine is particularly extremely sharp for a Hoga, like surprisingly sharp. But then, you know, the edges still has the blurriness and the vignetting that a Hoga is kind of famous for. But that center area is just like crazy sharp for a Hoga. And so I got really lucky, and many tears will be shed if this thing ever breaks. So,
yeah, I do have a Holga too. I actually have two of them. I have a black one and I have a red one. Mm. And the black one is miles above the red one, and they're exactly the same camera.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of inconsistency on those things for sure. I saw, I think it was Alex Purcell had a blue one. a blue Hoga, and blue's like my favorite color. I was like, oh, I gotta get me a blue Hoga. But I know like the chances of me getting one as good as the one I have now, like there's no way. Like I got the perfect one. So like I haven't really even bothered trying to get another one. Cause I was like, I'll never want to shoot it because I know I've got this one that just, it just has that perfect. I just got really lucky, and I'm afraid to try my luck on trying another one, even though a blue Hoga would be super awesome. But
well, it's a Holga. You could paint it.
Well, that's true. That's true. But it might lose its. It might get mad at me and lose its mojo. You know. So I don't.
I went and I bought a roll of gaff tape, and like, I don't like to spend as much as I don't have to.
Right.
And the roll of like bright blue gaff tape was like half the price of the regular black stuff, so I bought that.
Mm-hmm.
But well, when you stick it all over,
stick it all gaff tape.
Yeah, I stick it all over the whole guy, and it's like sticks out like a sore thumb. And I thought that was not smart. I can't repair any cameras with this blue tape. But it works, and actually, once I got using it, it's better because I can write on it. And the reason I say
maybe that's what I'll do.
Get a roll of blue gaff tape.
Yeah. Yeah. See, Sherry, you're costing me money. Now I gotta go buy some blue gaff tape. So yeah.
But I don't like if I don't write down what's in the camera and stick it on the camera, I will forget.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the same way. I actually use an app for that. Like I have an app that just keeps up with film rolls for me. So I can remember what's in cameras and people make fun of me like, oh yeah, why don't you just, write it on a piece of tape? Why do you need an app for that? I was like, because I don't know. I just got to put it in the app, man. It feels more technological or something. I don't know.
But you see, when I'm done shooting, I take the piece of tape off and stick it on the roll of film four rolls of Kodak gold. What's on them?
Right. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And I really should do it that way. I'll tell you one thing that the app does help me with though. Like sometimes I'll be like at work or just be away from my cameras and I'll be thinking about, oh man, tomorrow I'm going to go out with my cameras. I'm going to finally get some chance to shoot, And so I can open up the app no matter where I'm at, even if I'm not near my cameras, see what cameras are loaded up with film and what films in them and be like, okay, I'll take that camera and this camera. So see, it does. There is some rhyme to my reason here, but
there you go. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, but usually I just keep the ones that have film in them on the table, and at the moment there are about four of them sitting there, and it's been so gray and dull, it's like, I don't want to go shoot, it's so yucky, like the light is horrible.
Yeah, that's. I know you guys get it probably even worse. We it's been pretty gray around here too. We did have some sun the last couple of days. I think tomorrow's going to be really nice and pretty warm, and maybe some sun. So maybe I'll get a chance to get out tomorrow. But I know I'm going to be up so late preparing for this 300th episode giveaway. That's probably not going to happen.
You know what happens here when the sun comes out?
People go crazy?
No, it gets extremely cold and you don't want to go outside.
Oh, wow. It's like, it's just like one of those crisp days, crisp sunny days. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, crap.
Wow. Yeah.
So, yeah, well, we managed to fill up an hour, Mike.
Well, there we go. There we go. Yeah. Sherry, we're professionals at this now. So, I mean, it doesn't surprise me one bit at all. So,
either that or we just talk a lot.
Yeah, I think that's rather obvious when you look at how many episodes I have out there. So
anyway, so I guess we should maybe share your socials with the world and call this a wrap.
Let's do it. Okay, you can see my photography on Instagram at GuttermanPhoto. On Facebook at Mike Gutterman Photography, and the podcast is the Negative Positives Podcast, and we have a Facebook group, the Negative Positives Film Photography Podcast Facebook group, and you should think about joining that because there is just a wonderful selection of people in the film community on that group, and extremely helpful, and I've just been blown away about how cool everybody's been on that group, so very cool.
Well, I have to say, that group is responsible for a lot of things that I never thought I would do. things like develop my own film, because that happened there.
They will talk you into a lot of things, that's for sure.
Well, I'm glad they did, though.
Yeah,
in the end.
Yeah, because you, I remember you being quite nervous about it, and you kind of went through a funny. Matter of fact, you even started on color, which is kind of the opposite of what most people do. So, you went in and you took the bull by the horns, Sherry, and I'm proud of you. So there you go.
Yeah, well, I didn't really have a lot of choice because the lab shut. So
right, yeah, and I think the thing of it is, like, I don't know if you're at this point with it yet, but I enjoy it. I actually like the process of developing film. I mean, it's not tedious to me. I think it's fun. It's like a little strange chemistry experiment. You know, I feel like a bit of a mad scientist when I do it. So, I think it's fun. So,
I do think it's fun too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I will let you go, and you can finish preparing for episode 300. This podcast won't come out for another couple of weeks. So,
okay.
It will be long past, and
I will be a much more rested man at that point. So
yes. And I guess that's all for now, and let's say goodbye to everybody.
See you.
Bye.
Everybody.
Hey, I hope you've enjoyed the show, and I'd really love to hear from you. Now, there's a few ways you can get in touch. You can use the Anchor app to do a 1-minute call into the show. You can record a voice memo on any smartphone and email that into the show, and I'll play them on air. Or you can just send me an email at embracethegrainpodcast@gmail.com, or you can send me a direct message over on Instagram. You can find me at embrace_the_grain. I'd really love to hear from you. And until next week, take care and don't be negative.